episode of the Postural Restoration Podcast. I believe we're almost a dozen or so episodes in, and today, really, you know, quite honestly, I wasn't sure that this was going to be a possibility to have today's guest on. I knew, you know, in my heart, I wanted to have it happen for many reasons, but the timing and, you know, scheduling of today and the guests we have is really quite an honor, and we're really excited to have him on. With us today is Neil Lempe, who is the head athletic trainer of the Los Angeles Dodgers. Neil, thank you so much for being with us today. Shortly before we began, I told Neil that I wouldn't take the time to go through all of his accolades because, quite frankly, they are lengthy. Neil, you're very conditioned, if you will, in the realm of sports medicine. Neil's an athletic trainer by trade and, you know, holds many credentials in fascial release and all sorts of different modalities. And that's really the reason why we're so excited to have you on, Neil, is to kind of get your input on really the integration of all those things. So thanks again for being here.
Thanks for having me, RJ.
Neil, generally, and for the listeners that have continued this journey with us so far, you know, I always thank them and appreciate, you know, their interest in all of these things and what we're going to discuss today. But so far, Neil, I've had mostly faculty, PRCs, but up until this point, mostly faculty members. And what we like to do is get a little history about you, and just so people that aren't familiar with you or have never met you, you know, get a feel for how you got to where you are today. Obviously, you don't get to be the head athletic trainer for a major MLB organization like you are. That doesn't happen overnight. We have a lot of people in the minor league level. We have a lot of people in college athletics, all these different avenues that are probably interested in how you got to where you are. Neil, I know, you know, you spent some of your collegiate years in Minnesota and Colorado and worked with different colleges throughout your years. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on those areas, but what we could walk through is maybe your first kind of major, you know, major league or minor league positionings. You know, part of that was with the University of Arizona. So maybe if we start kind of in that time range, walk us through how you got involved with baseball in general. You know, if that was always an interest of yours, again, the time you spent at the University of Arizona, some of the mentors that we talked about earlier there, and how those people kind of formed your path to where you are today.
Got it. Well, let me start by saying I'm trying to figure out what I want to be when I grow up, RJ. I don't know that that'll ever end. You know, I think it's kind of I kind of thrive in the idea of being a living in the gray or being a mutt or a utility guy is kind of how I've always perceived it. But I think even if we take it a step further back, you know, I graduated undergrad and you're kind of like, all right, I'm supposed to know a lot of things right now. And you really don't. It's just kind of the beginning of your career, and that's where your learning starts. And then I was fortunate enough at the University of Minnesota to where I was a strength and conditioning coach for a year, that I just got to watch human movement for roughly, you know, 60 hours a week. And you had way more questions than you had answers. And from the University of Minnesota, you know, I went to Colorado, Boulder Center for Sports Medicine, got to work with a lot of high school athletes, alternative sport athletes. So now you're seeing a different type of movement from a different age group. And again, more questions than answers. I went from Boulder to the University of Arizona for 5 years. I actually started my master's degree. The question I kept asking, or, you know, my thought has always been, there's more to this. Like, there's more to this. You know, I'm not sure what that is, but I know there's more to this. I actually started out in my master's degree as a sports psych master's student, and I thought that was the more to this piece. And then I kind of gravitated into the strength and conditioning realm. University of Arizona, I was a strength and conditioning coach. You know, I was a certified athletic trainer, but I was never really taught how to use my hands. And, you know, I had the athletic trainer eye, the injury prevention eye working, the performance eye, how do we improve performance eye. and I felt like I was missing something, and the soft tissue piece really helped augment that piece for me. And while I was at the University of Arizona, I worked with a number of different teams, football, men's basketball, volleyball, soccer, and I worked with baseball at the University of Arizona as well. And Nate Shaw, I believe, reached out and asked, hey, you know, Nate Shaw's the strength and conditioning coach for the Arizona Diamondbacks. Hey, do you guys have any good interns? Anyone you'd recommend? We're always looking to get good people into the pipeline. And that just started a dialogue with the Arizona Diamondbacks staff and Ken Crenshaw at the time, the head athletic trainer. And, you know, next thing you know it, you have some like-minded guys having some conversations that are a little bit on the fringe, you know, athletic trainer in a major league team and a strength coach at a college talking about diaphragms, you know, 13, 14 years ago was a little bit different. And so, you know, we started to, you know, I'd drive up to Phoenix every once in a while and we'd talk shop. I'd invite him down to the U of A. And at the time, you know, baseball kind of had a head athletic trainer, an assistant athletic trainer, and a strength coach. So those three positions. And then obviously as performance and sports medicine grew and developed, you needed more staff. And I was fortunate enough that they kind of created a new full-time position. And it really spoke to me, A, from my curiosity of what it would be like to work in professional athletics and professional sports, and B, to be able to have your job be kind of one of those utility jobs of, you know, a little bit of time in the weight room, some rehab, some treatment, to kind of feed all those different pieces for yourself professionally.
Well, you know, a lot of our guests so far on this, on the podcast, Neil, have all resoundingly stated how initially you just kind of land in this spot. Like you just all of a sudden find yourself surrounded by these people that you never even you can't even foresee, you know, like you said, being a collegiate strength coach. And I want to take a second to just mention the fact that Nate Shaw's name came up with one of our faculty, Takashi, who also is kind of in the baseball realm. He did an internship down there with those guys. But Nate in particular, it seems like has a way of like reaching out to people at the right times and also just like finding a way to become involved with them. You know, I'll definitely have Nate on the show at some point in time. But like I said, you kind of landed in this circle of people where, you know, to me, knowing a little bit about your history really opened the door for you to get into that, as you said, professional involvement, kind of that next step in your career. Maybe just talk to us a little bit, Neil, about that position that you kind of, that they kind of hybridly created for you with the Diamondbacks. I, from my knowledge, you were kind of a manual performance therapist initially is what it was called. And at the time, like you said, in MLB or all sports in general, you had an athletic trainer, a strength coach, and maybe, you know, a nutritionist, an LMT, or, you know, there's like a handful of positions. And this wasn't one of those. So walk us through kind of how that came about, what that role looked like at the time, and how that kind of opened the door for you.
I think where it grew, and this is, you know, you talked about, obviously, you know, Nate has a gift for you know, seeking infinite and reaching out to people. And you know, obviously Ken Crenshaw as well, just that's one of his gifts is to connect people and to reach out. And, you know, I think he had a vision of what it looked like to have a sports medicine and performance staff a long time ago, and that it truly is one department. Obviously you have your separate expertise, but it's one family, one department, and it's integrated. And you know, there's no walls up and open communication and agree to disagree at times, as long as it's in the best interest of the athlete. And so I think part of the reason that we were drawn to each other was, you know, having a diverse skill set to maybe take someone outside and do a return to play running progression was like, why would your massage guy, quote unquote, right? Your massage guy take someone out to do a running progression, or why is your strength coach doing soft tissue work on someone? And our thought would be, why not? Right? Like, if that's, how do you put people in positions of strength? How do you put people in, how do you feed people? And that's how you create a pretty special environment where A, the athlete's getting served really well, the employees, staff members, team individuals are being fed, and that's how you grow something. I think from a like-minded standpoint, you know.
That's really, like you said, one of not only Nate and Ken, but that whole group, you know, we can look at it from an outside view today, and from us in a PRI world, the Institute and all of us, you know, it's easy to recognize that immediately when you do find a group like that. And now, you know, I would put myself out on a limb and say they have really changed the culture of that side of sports performance and sports medicine in general across the board for you know, not just baseball, but really how others look to them and how they've created this integrative team. Like you said, you know, what is a massage therapist doing some of these things for? It's they really take away people's boxes. I've talked about that with other guests, not being confined to, you know, what your title says you are. And how awesome is that, that was kind of your starting point. So really pretty lucky to start off where you did, if we call a spade a spade.
Well, and then I obviously, you know, to be in that environment for 8 years and to kind of help them grow that and watch it continue to evolve. And then, you know, obviously to go to the rival within the division to move, you know, 380 miles west of Phoenix to the Dodgers. And obviously then, you know, it's one thing to have a playbook. It's another thing to execute it and to figure out what the environment entails, what the culture is that you're adopting, and how do you grow something from what you've learned in the past yet to make it, you know, for us, a Dodgers culture now, having learned what I did from my mentors, you know, Ken and a number of people that have helped me throughout my career. How do you take those lessons and kind of pay it forward to try to grow something wherever you're going? And right now that's with the Los Angeles Dodgers, obviously.
Yeah.
So we play those guys 18 times a season. So, I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, you still see each other. There's still a little, obviously, you know, tongue in cheek and rivalry and who's going to get the best of who.
Well, and so, at the end of the I think it's fair to say you still love each other. You know, at the end of all of it, you're all trying to do the same thing for your own athletes. Like you said, you learn a system, and we'll get into kind of PRI and some other systems that you use. But, you know, whether you learn it from someone and end up going somewhere else with it, it's still up to you to learn to integrate that and use it how you need to. So one thing I do want to kind of, while we're on the subject of the Diamondbacks, Neil, I'm guessing that it was around this time, and this will kind of lead us into some other topics here, but I don't know what your first recollection, or if you can recall, you know, your first exposure to PRI, and whether that was, you know, in Arizona with them. You know, I know it was about the same time, somewhere around that, you know, 05. I'm not sure when your first course was, but how did you first get involved? Obviously you had a lot of other skill sets, trainings. You know, at that point you were probably, you know, fascially trained to do different hands-on release, you know, I know you're trained in active release techniques as well, DNS and some of these other modalities that we'll get into, but how did you first hear about PRI, and was it actually through Ken or any of those guys?
It was actually a bit of a flip-flop almost. The first time I had heard anything was from a friend of mine, Paul Meyer. And
Okay.
Paul at the time was the athletic trainer for the US ski team. And he had taken a Myokin course, goodness, probably in 2006 maybe, with Ron. And he's like, hey, like, it's going to dump it on your head. It's going to kind of make you relearn things of how you learned them in school. He goes, but I'm getting really good results, you know, obviously with downhill alpine skiers and hip issues and knees and whatnot. And, you know, it's one of those things where you have certain colleagues and friends that when certain people tell you to do certain things, you don't have to do a lot of homework. You take their word
You
for it.
just
So
go do it,
obviously,
yeah.
exactly. So that was kind of one of the things that Paul had said, like, why don't you flip that stone over? Why don't you see what's under that rock? And that's when I signed up for Myokin. I think it was maybe 2006 or 2007, and it was hosted by Alan Gruver, and James Anderson taught that course, and I
Did
got
that?
dumped on my head.
Did that take you back to, was it didn't happen to be at the Arizona University of Arizona, did it? Or
It was before that even.
okay.
University of Arizona had not even kind of heard of PRI at the time. It was at the old Rejuvenation Center in Chandler,
Okay.
Arizona. So a colleague and I drove up to Phoenix from Tucson. You know, took James Myokin course for 2 days, and I was driving. This is a true story. I was driving back after that 2 day course on the 10, which is a, you know, freeway in the desert where most people set the cruise at 85, 45 miles an hour on the freeway heading back to Tucson. Just kind of thinking through what I had been learning and hashing through on the weekend. And so,
Without even probably realizing that you were going like half of normal speed.
yeah, no, exactly. Cars are flying by me, and I'm, my head was way out there, just as far as, you know, the concepts that I had been exposed to the first time, and just a different, you know, construct of thinking and seeing the body in a different lens. And it was, you know, I couldn't sign up for postural respiration fast enough. One of Lori's pelvis courses was in Arizona. Luckily, there was quite a few courses being hosted in Arizona at the time while I was there, so it made it easier for me to be able to kind of get through the curriculum, pretty good because of the availability of courses in our area to match up our schedule.
Yeah, and
So.
well, and I was kind of, you mentioned it was kind of reverse of what I said. Really, PRI in your area at that time was, as you said, kind of growing in Arizona itself. There for a while, we hosted a lot of courses, Flagstaff, Phoenix, Tucson, you name it. Eventually, we've now hosted quite a bit at the U of A as well. But, you were in another setting where it was happening around you, so it was kind of like this growing, you almost probably had it, circling whether you liked it or not. It was in your physical location and in your realm, so to speak. Neil, so from let's say that was around 2006, you get involved with taking courses. At that point, were you still kind of involved with other teachings, other trainings? Was a lot of your other schooling concurrently happening with some of your other modalities, or walk us through kind of some of the other coursework you were taking at the time?
So during that window, you know, I was kind of myself and Trey Tashiro, who was one of the athletic trainers at the U of A, were the only two that really had any exposure to PRI. And luckily, we had met Alan Gruver while we were at the course that he was hosting. And so, you know, at the time, Alan's kind of running a clinic, and we're strength coaches and athletic trainers at the U of A. And so I would invite Alan down. I didn't have much of a budget to pay him to be, you know, what he was worth, so to speak. So I would have him down. I'd pay for a round of golf. I'd take him out for pizza. He'd stay at the house. He'd come in, do an eval on some athletes. We'd kind of get a bit of a game plan for some of the athletes that he would see. And it was one of those things where as you're young in the PRI world, I'd be like, hey, Alan, can you come down a month from now, you know, or in 2 weeks, and say it'd be a month between he comes down and visit. And I'd be like, yeah, she's doing really good with those exercises. And now I'd be like, oh, she'd probably a week after going forward. Again, I'm still, to this day, I'm fumbling forward through different things. But Alan was really instrumental in helping accelerate and help me appreciate, you know, that PRI lens when I went to massage therapy school as well. So, and you're saying, ah, maybe that's why this tissue and this tissue feel different, even though it's the same body part, right versus left side. Why is there a difference? Why is their complaint tend to be more on this side?
Some of those, you know, early concepts. You're palpating, yeah,
and learning to use your hands. Why is there more tone?
Yeah.
Yeah. You so, just start to kind of connect some dots. Another mentor of mine, Claire Frank, and kind of the Prague school of rehab. She's very deeply ingrained in that world, the Yanda concepts, the DNS stuff. I, in that same window of time, I'd taken one of Claire's courses, you know, Yanda approach. So again, you just start to piece together stuff that you don't learn in school, and you just continue to ask more questions and see what that looks like in practice, and kind of fumble forward, and then try to, you know, while respecting the science, kind of make it your art and make a mistake, and then learn from that and refine the mistake and resequence things and watch different bodies move. And maybe one approach speaks to you more. You gravitate towards something, how someone's presenting. You know, that's a big thing that you learn. It's like everybody's telling you a story, right? Like how they walk in the door, what's their demeanor, what's their posture, what's their, you know, nervous system telling you. And you just start to kind of formulate what their story is and what your game plan to help facilitate, you know, improvement for them, whatever that may be for that athlete on that day. Yeah. Based yeah. off of being able to read that story, so to speak.
Well, and before we get into kind of the story about how you currently integrate with your athletes, and, you know, we talked earlier about recognizing patterns, and as you just mentioned, kind of this neurological story of what's behind the athlete's presentation. What are they, why are they presenting the way that they are, and what limitations are causing this? We'll get into all that, Neil. Before we do that, I want to kind of just briefly mention, you know, at some point you became certified in PRI, much like a lot of those other modalities. Again, we kind of talked earlier about how it was probably around the time of 2011 or 2012, maybe, because you were the second class, but the PRT credential, Postural Restoration Trained, which kind of encompasses your field, you know, strength coaches, athletic trainers. You know, there's a cool story behind this, Neil, with you involved. And I want to just quickly, you know, for the listeners, talk about how at the time where your peak interest in the science and your credentialing occurred, as I mentioned, you were part of the second PRT class just because of timing. But walk us through kind of your involvement with how the PRT credential became a actual path and an actual credential. You know, I mentioned to you earlier that, and I mention this all the time, Neil, when people ask me, you know, I go to different shows throughout the year. I'm talking to, sometimes it's dentists, sometimes it's chiropractors, sometimes it's X, Y, or Z. And people don't really often know that, like, we really were a physical therapy institute at our foundation, at our core. Ron's a PT, James, all these guys, and you know, ladies and on our faculty, you know, we're still heavily PT oriented, but at the time where your involvement and your interest in the science was growing, that started to change. We became not only, you know, we've always been a multidisciplinary institute. We've always prided ourselves on integration with other fields. But walk us through how, you know, you had this little story, so to speak, of how the PRT credential came about.
I remember the PRC was kind of the sole credential at the time, and there was obviously prerequisites for that and totally understandable. And I was like, oh man, like I think it was PTs, PTAs at the time. And it's probably, quite honestly, looking back, it's probably based on that clinical setting. And those were the predominant professionals in that clinical setting, were PTs, PTAs, whatnot. And I was like, well, darn, man, you know, athletic trainers. And it just so happened that I believe I went to advanced integration in Lincoln in 2010. And I think they were just accepting applications for the PRT at the time, which was the first class, I believe, was 2011. And I looked at it and I was like, ah, man, like it's one day. There's not really a manual component to it. I'm like, at the time in the back of my head, I thought, well, is this kind of a watered down version of the PRC? And, you know, and just like anything, as the Institute grows, they needed to start somewhere with acknowledging what I now understand and appreciate. And Jason actually helped with that piece in coming into our PRT course and talking to our group. But it was more of a credential to create a universal appreciation for a new setting. Maybe that's the sports medicine and performance realm more than the clinical PT realm. And I now know that, obviously, after having a spirited discussion with Ron during one of the breaks of that advanced integration, because I told him, I said, listen, I know I'm quote unquote, you know, I'm an athletic trainer. I said, but if I don't understand your material well enough and don't show competence in a PRC setting, I said, by no means would I want you to pass me. I wouldn't want you to water down the material, the science, and have someone have a credential that isn't appreciating the science how you would like for them to. And so I think a lot of the PRI faculty wanted to string me up because I think that forced maybe some further conversations. And I apologize to the faculty for that, but I was pretty passionate at the time about, you know, wanting to be a part of things and where that, for lack of a better term, a growing pain of the Institute in that transition of acknowledging different professions. And what does that look like of skill sets? And, you know, you obviously have state licensures and you have certifications and how do you meld all of this? And it was very young as they were starting to formulate what the PRT was going to be. And so, you know, they had that first class and the dust kind of settled. And I think that, you know, I truly mean this when I say this, I've had the privilege to be able to help with the PRT process for a handful of years, both in person in Lincoln, as well as being able to review some of the applications. And to this day, I would say that my PRT process was one of the most valuable, like, educational opportunities I've had in, you know, 20 plus years and being a professional, of having an application process that you could say, I'm going to get out of this what I put into it. And I want to, you know, get under the hood with each of these questions, with your case study, with your exercise selection. And then to be able to show up in Lincoln after your application gets received and hoping that you dotted your I's and crossed your T's to have a quality application to get in, and then to be able to, you know, to take the exam and to go through the practical application and to be able to have Ron's kind of undivided attention in a smaller group for, you know, a day and a half, 2 days, was absolutely invaluable in my growth in that. And then when I was asked to be involved, I thought to myself, I'd be an absolute idiot not to be able to get his back pocket in those small group settings in any opportunity I get. And it's just been a fantastic experience for me from that time of me approaching Ron during a break during advanced integration 10 years ago, saying, hey, like, if I don't know the material, fail me, but like,
give me the chance.
Let's figure out what these settings or different professionals and credentials look like in their world. So again, I feel like I need to apologize to the faculty because I think there were some conversations after that about, you know, what direction does this take and how does this look for us moving forward? But I mean, needless to say, you guys are absolutely, like they say, the Institute isn't the brick and mortar. Obviously it's a beautiful building, but the Institute's the people, right? And, you know, I feel like Ron encourages us, you know, I am a part of the Institute. You're correct, a part of the Institute. There's people all over the country, all over the world that are the Institute because of how they continue to go through these growing pains and grow out what the Institute stands for.
Yeah.
And I was just a little bump in the road during a little intermission of an advanced integration course.
I don't think you were a bump. I don't think you need to apologize. You know, there's people, like you just mentioned, there's people all over the world that are part of our Institute. And I thank you so much for putting it that way, because often I even get, you know, I start saying, you know, us at the Institute or the Institute has grown over the years into be multidisciplinary and so integrative, but really it's the people like yourself and all over the world that are a part of that. You know, I look at now some of our faculty. Skip George is our first chiropractor on faculty. You look at guys like Chad Morrow and these different, you know, that's another chiropractic involvement. But these areas that still today are new and young, just like the PRT and the athletic training field was at the time where you got involved. So it's not like, you know, it's not like we're ever turning down these opportunities or building a wall between us and any other involvement. It's quite opposite. It's just basically waiting for the right people like yourself and like, you know, these other groups of people that are involved with us now, waiting for the certain people to push you in that direction or to pull you and say, you know, we're here, we're ready. Not only am I ready, you know, not only were you ready, but your field in general and the licensure that you held and the boundaries within your practice, that those things were all ready for more involvement. So I don't think the apology is necessary. if anything, we should be apologizing, saying, you know, sorry, it didn't happen sooner. But anyways, you know, that's just kind of a fun story and a real quick side note to that, Neil. And I'm sure we've told you this since you are involved with PRT throughout the years. And I know all of us get so excited to have you a part of that process when you come and help out in Lincoln. Unfortunately, we had to cancel this summer testing this year due to our current times with the virus. But we look forward to it in January. And I know we'll see you back at some point for future testings. But we've probably told you this, but recently there's been more people, as you know, there's a lot of people that are dually credentialed as physical therapists and athletic trainers. I want to just mention, you know, you kind of hit upon this earlier where you didn't want it to be a watered down version of a credential that already existed. That's one of our biggest things that we want to get across to people. The PRT credential is no different as far as its weight in gold in comparison to the PRC. And really, I know that was probably one of the biggest headaches or hiccups with how they needed to set that up initially. You know, when you kind of went there and opened the envelope, so to speak, is how do you make a separate credential for separate individuals in a different setting hold the same merit and the same value as a clinical setting? And I think, you know, a little bit pridefully, I'd say that we did a fairly decent job of containing, you know, both of those credentialing processes are so alike and so similar. You come out with the same knowledge, the same appreciation, the same testing, as you mentioned, the physical one-on-one time that you go through in those 2 days acknowledging what your strengths are, what your weaknesses are within the science itself, there's absolutely no difference between the two. And where I was going with this is we actually have some PTs that become PRT certified with their athletic training side of things, because that's more of what they feel like is relevant in their life, is that non-clinical, you know, whether it be sports medicine or whatever they do. Maybe they work with athletes or in universities, but it's so cool to see people have that opportunity to look at themselves, look in the mirror and say, what process do I fit, and what process fits me, so to speak. So it's really cool to see both sides of those.
While you were speaking there, RJ, I was thinking of Jessica. She was in the PRT core class a couple years ago.
Yep.
PT, Utah, University of Utah, ski environment. And, you know, I know Jen and Ron were pretty impressed that she, as a PT, you know, ATC, she kind of chose the PRT route. And I think it was her having a conversation about what are the you know,
kind of
similarities,
what we just
differences,
talked about. Yeah.
Exactly, the setting. And I remember Jess kind of saying, yes, I have both credentials, but this is the setting I spend the most time in. And I feel like it may lend myself to go this direction with the credentialing process. And, you know, hopefully it's serving her well in taking that path, obviously.
Well, and I know both of us spend a lot of time with people that are both PRCs and PRTs, and you can be in the room with 50 people and not know the difference of who is who or what is what, because of, you know, even what we talked about earlier is just like taking the box away from people, you know.
Yeah.
Let's say you're an LMT on paper, but, or even a PRT or a PRC on paper, well, you get in a room with 50 other like-minded people and none of that really, you know, that's not the important issue at hand. So it's just kind of a cool topic to talk about. I know you had, you know, obviously you're still involved with the PRT process, and really it has become, and it is what it is today because of not only you, but people like you that are the Institute that help direct and guide us. So I know we really appreciate it, Neil, and I hope you have fun doing it as well. I think you do. So,
absolutely.
Neil, let's jump back here quickly before, you know, we take too much of your time, but let's get into a little bit of what a typical, I kind of laughed when I said typical there, because right now everything is atypical for you as far as your current season and your role, if you will, and what's thrown at you every day. So let's not think about current times, you know, currently with seasons and scheduling and player involvement, but let's go back maybe a year or two and just think about what a typical year is for you, and not necessarily seasonally, but, you know, your work doesn't end when the season ends. You have athletes all year round, postseason training. And I know today more than ever, you know, athletic trainers are more involved than ever with player, you know, player personnel, player care, you know, rehab kind of outlooks and guiding what their really player care looks like. So as the head athletic trainer, I know you always haven't, you've had many other roles before being the head athletic trainer with the Dodgers, but once you got into this head athletic training position, just walk us through, like, you know, what your involvement is typically with, let's just say, one or two athletes that either are going through rehab or, you know, let's say it's, you know, in the middle of the season and you're in charge of kind of being that integration between them, some of the other sports medicine professionals on your team, how you guys work together, and just really what some of that looks like for you.
Sure. Oof, that's a loaded question.
It's a long question, but kind of how you know what your role is, I would say, and how that then trickles down into their care.
Sure. I think the best way to maybe put it is like some words that I would say are synonymous to my position. You're kind of the quarterback. I'm a facilitator. I look at the job maybe in two roles. There's player care, which is going to obviously, you want to be able to give your manager the 25, 26 players that he's wanting to go out and win a game on that day. So the player care piece is of paramount importance, obviously. And then there's the kind of the staff development piece and culture piece. So those are kind of, there's obviously a lot of sub areas amongst that, but those are how I look at my current role, are those two positions, and they really feed hand in hand. So as much as baseball is unique from other sports in that there's an entire minor league system where you can have 200 to 300 additional quote unquote, they're professional athletes. They get paid to play baseball. And I think the number is roughly like 3% of professional baseball players will ever wear a Major League Baseball uniform. But our job is to give those players the best chance to go through a system to reach that goal. And the game is already hard enough. You have, you know, anywhere from, you know, 7 affiliate teams plus or minus all over the country, an academy in the Dominican. And so one of the biggest things that was of importance when I came over to the Dodgers was to try to establish not only a culture amongst the sports medicine staff, but also some continuity of care. So that if a player is getting promoted through the system, they have some stability in knowing what the approach will be in the training room, no matter which, the AA training room or AAA training room or Major League training room. So to try to get some consistency in the philosophically what our sports medicine group stands for and what we hold in high regard. And so that was a really important piece. And a part of that is developing the staff that you have and bringing in people that can help grow that. I think Steve Jobs may have been the one to make the comment, you don't hire people to tell them what to do. You hire people so they can tell you what to do. And you know, it's kind of the idea that, you know, you leave your ego at the door and everyone kind of put their ideas out on the table to figure out what's in the best interest of the athlete. And so that's really kind of how our group operates. You know, we try to foster a mentor-mentee relationship no matter who you – like, I have – mentors within the organization that are helping me in some areas where I'm professionally growing currently. And then I am, so I'm the mentee in that regard, obviously. And then I, you know, in certain areas that maybe I have a grasp on that some of our younger professionals are working on, I can help mentor them. So it's always really good, I feel like, for people to be both a teacher and a student in different aspects. And so that's something that we try to foster. And then another big piece, RJ, that we've kind of implemented the last couple years is as we try to work on that continuity and consistency of care for the athletes is creating a curriculum for our sports medicine professionals. Our sports medicine group's about 20 people, minor league, spring training facility, major league, LA-based sports medicine group. It's about 20 people. And so, you know, having, for example, the PRI primary care, the primary courses, that's part of our curriculum. We have some kind of, so we have some, say, 100 level courses that we want our group that we help facilitate and get them a Con Ed allowance to get through this curriculum that we would want. You know, we have some soft tissue courses, some evaluation courses, some performance courses, to kind of round them out for that universal continuity piece. But exactly. With that being said, once we get them through that, the last thing that we want to do is inhibit the ability for them to be a critically thinking professional or have autonomy in how they provide care. So once they get through some of those universal courses, that's when we say, hey, like, what sets you on fire? What are you passionate about? What type of clinician do you want to become? And then also support that piece as almost peripheral electives once we get that foundation set for the professionals. And so that's been a really big shift that we've been working on
throughout the whole.
Ken Crenshaw, good friend, thinks Yeah, things never happen as fast as you like, but you know, things are definitely trending in the right direction in that regard. And so, you know, that's where, you know, day in and day out, to get back to your question, you know, we're going to get a lot of numbers. We're going to do things, some testing in the weight room and force plate testing, and what are some of our asymmetries that we need to be concerned about. We get all of this information that we gather in spring training. We get together as a group, we print it out, you know, we give everyone access to that. I usually give them a few days to comb through everyone's, so that everyone has their eyes on the same information, but everyone has a different lens on the same information. And so we'll just go player by player and round table. Hey, what do you see? Is there anything that's concerning? And what's going to be our course of action and our plan for this athlete with anything that we may see as being concerning? Everyone puts that out on the table based on what they're seeing through their lens, and we formulate a game plan for that athlete.
And then it
So that's
changes
kind
a
of what
week
spring
later.
training is.
And
No, absolutely, right? Absolutely.
So
Absolutely. So
one of
that's kind
the
of what spring training is for us. So those are kind of your 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. days.
yeah, and you know, as you finally end up with the unit that you have for the year, for the you know, actual season, not spring training, and once you get into, you know, regular season play, hopefully by that time, not only does your staff kind of have a cohesive, you know, grip on things, but the players themselves kind of know their own treatment, you know, plans. They all kind of know, okay, here's the guy I go to for this. You know, maybe I don't need to see, you know, I don't need to see Steve over here because he's not part of my plan of care. And then again, it could change tomorrow. So I know briefly while we were on the topic of PRT, just a quick mention that you have Andrew Hauser in-house with you, and you know, obviously a huge benefit to have another like-minded individual that, you know, you talked about building this team and building this really this unit that you're all bringing something different to the table, but you all can appreciate your own lenses. Really just such a great, you know, he's a great asset. I know all of your team is a great asset in their own ways. You mentioned something kind of interesting, Neil, when you compared your current role to kind of, you know, a quarterback or a, you know, the ringleader, so to speak. When it comes to communicating as a team, do you go and reach out to those other individuals to get them involved, or do your athletes reach out to you when they have X, Y, or Z pain or impingement, or how do you guys bounce back and forth off of each other, and how does that get initiated most often?
You know, one of the biggest changes I had from college to professional sports is, especially, you know, Major League Baseball, and you know, they're part of a union. You can't really make anyone do anything. So really, there has to be a lot of front end social equity put in with the players, and to build those relationships and to learn personalities. And to know what does it look like for this guy when he's afraid. There's an injury. They're worried about their career. There's a lot of context that goes into decisions of, is it a contract year? How are things at home? Is this a re-injury of the same thing? How did that play out for them in the past? And then, you know, you have your staff where our group, everyone has different personalities and temperaments, and certain player personalities and temperaments gravitate towards others, and we welcome that, and we encourage, you know, players to kind of go through our whole group. Obviously, like you said, everyone in our on our staff may have different kind of subspecialties, if you will, or people who can do certain things, to where the players all know that it's almost like a pit crew, right? Like we all work together. Every day before the day starts, we have a staff meeting to kind of do a debrief on where guys are at, what our plan is for guys, whether they're able and active and we're trying to keep them rolling, whether they're a short-term, you know, injured list player, a longer-term post-op rehab. So that everyone's kind of in the know of where they're at, so that kind of that assembly line of care is as well orchestrated as we can have that be. But to give the staff, to empower the staff and to give them the autonomy to kind of execute a plan, again, within the construct, and so that everyone's in the know, and then coordinating that with the strength and conditioning coaches, you know, Brandon McDaniel, Travis Smith, down in our weight room, so that they know, hey, this time of day they're heading down, to make sure that you don't have any gaps in your care or in your rehab plan or treatment plan, or that you're not being redundant and doubling up on things. So obviously the communication piece is of paramount
huge
importance in that, for sure.
Yeah, one of the, you know, I've talked to other people in, let's say, soccer, you know, MLS or other, you know, major league sports, if you will. But one of the questions I always find kind of interesting, Neil, and I want to kind of get your perspective on, is do the athletes themselves, you talked about kind of the player buy-in and being that importance in their own, you know, you guys have to build up your role within their own lives so that they want to come see, they want you to be a part of their career and their plan. But do players at this point have an appreciation for things like PRI or DNA, or they say, I need to go see, you know, the myofunctional therapist, I need to go get some fascial release, or I need to go do my PRI exercises with Hauser or Neil. Do you guys, is it at a point where players recognize those things when they need them? Or do you still find yourself kind of having to guide that? I mean, I didn't, you know, again, with other sports, I've talked to other people involved with athletics. You have some athletes that obviously are more competent with their own care than others, and they are very active with that process. But is PRI recognized within your player group? Again, not just PRI, but other modalities. Do they know, okay, this is being done for this reason, or I need to go reposition, I need to go do my breathing work so that I can have range of motion back, or you know, whatever it may be?
Yeah, I think that's obviously changing by the year, as far as the athletes becoming more informed consumers about their care, their health, and whatnot. And as, you know, obviously there's a PRI baseball course, as teams or organizations do that, and through free agency or through trades, or, oh, we did a little bit of that in this organization, or, no, I haven't done any of that. But I actually steal this term from Andrew. You had mentioned Andrew earlier, Andrew Hauser, who's been a fantastic addition to our group, to say the least. What we call it is slow cooking things. You know, you can't make big changes. We see these guys every day, and if you make these big monumental shifts in their care, there's an element of fear that comes with that. And our whole thing is on the slow cook, is if we just get 5 minutes, 10 minutes with a guy, but we can get the compliance and the buy-in in those smaller windows, versus maybe ideally saying, oh man, I would love to have 35 minutes with this guy, and for you to get that for a few days and then to never see him again, you know, we kind of added it up. If you get 5 or 10 minutes a day with a guy, that's an entire 40-hour work week by the end of a season that you've been able to slow cook some of these habits or approaches with a guy. And we always kind of try to bookend it with education as to why that's important for them in their world as it relates to what they're trying to get done. And the guys do acknowledge, you know, PRI, and it may be depending on where they train in their off seasons and the techniques and ability and modalities and approaches at the, you know, performance facility that they train in, or the PT who sublets out of that facility who treats them after their workouts and whatnot. And again, we always welcome conversations with those guys, because that's how you build trust, not saying, hey, come to my world, this is how we're going to do it. You know, let them kind of lead that conversation, let them have some ownership of it. That's where you really get the mileage out of those relationships. And you're going to get anything from, you know, a 19-year-old Mexican pitcher phenom who may have not a lot of base on that realm, to the early mid-30s free agent who knows their body inside and out. They know what they need. And again, that's where you just learn to read a room and to meet them where they're at. You know, John Berardi and Precision Nutrition have a great grid. It's kind of, you know, high intelligent, high motivation, high intelligent, low motivation, low intelligent, high motivation, low intelligent, low motivation. And, you know, you put someone in those four grids, you have to have some tools to meet wherever they may be on those grids, as well as their ability to articulate and let you know what they perceive they need. And sometimes you have to give them that piece to get maybe where you're wanting to take them as well. You know, something that we've talked in the past about a little bit, RJ, is where a lot of the injuries in baseball are kind of pattern-based. You know, a acute traumatic injury is getting hit by a pitch, getting cleated on turning a double play at second base, diving and hitting a wall. But the reality of the number of injuries that are actually those traumatic injuries are very small. A lot of them are patterned, threshold-based injuries of volumes and intensities, and their body finally saying, hey, like, I've been talking to you, you haven't listened, I need to screen now. And they hit a threshold in a pattern that creates pain for them. And so they still need to play. And so we have to meet them and use maybe some of the modalities in our toolbox to acutely get them out of that pain and manage that for them to be able to play. All the while, we step back and say, why did this happen? Is there a pattern in place? Is there a volume issue? Is there an intensity issue? Are there outside of baseball issues where the stressors coming in, as we look at that performance or case study puzzle per athlete to say, you know, what is contributing to how they're presenting and how can we give them what they need in the immediate? And then how do we help prevent that down the road as well?
Yeah. Well,
so that's kind of always the conversation we're having.
Yeah. That kind of ties into, you know, you mentioned, well, here's kind of how preseason, you know, this is preseason versus in-season versus postseason, spring training, whatever it may be. Obviously, your plan of care changes because you don't have 3 to 5 games a week during preseason. You know, the different timing and the different phases of your year changes how you do things. And that's kind of one of my last questions for you, Neil, is between, let's say, a maintenance, let's say you're working with a player on just maintaining end ranges, or, you know, let's say it's pitching. I mean, people get tired of hearing about pitching in baseball because it's like all people, you know, it's like the number one, maybe you will disagree, but it's like injury after injury with pitching mechanics and overhead throwing and athletes. But let's say you're in a maintenance phase with someone, does their appreciation for these things we're talking about go up after they after a injury does occur? I mean, obviously you have a young kid who might have never had you know, some of these torsions or strains or impingements, or they've never sublet, you know, you have all these different things. But does their appreciation for these modalities increase after an injury?
Yeah, I think it's human nature for people to say, I don't have pain, I'm healthy. And especially in this population, you kind of get a 20-something alpha male type A. Unfortunately, at times, it may take an injury before you get a captive audience. And that's your window to educate and to get a plan in place for them so that when they come back from an injury, you have had conversations about habits and the value of what you do prior to activity, how you finish your day, for them to then say, ah. Or they learn how to find and feel and breathe into a posterior mediastinum, and you just see their tone drop at the end of the day, because they may be crawling in bed at 1 a.m. after they leave the ballpark at 11 or 11:30 p.m. and think I'm ready to sleep, but their body is still in a posture that they don't know the difference if they're going to bed or getting chased by a lion still. They don't know if they went 0 for 4 with 4 strikeouts on a contract year or about to get T-boned through a red light. Yeah. So, like, to give them tools and say, ah, okay, I feel a little better. I feel heavier. I feel relaxed. I can rotate and it's easier. It's easier for me to do the same thing. So that's where you get these little, as you slow cook some of those things that we talked about earlier, and you get these little victories, you kind of capture, you know, you get a captive audience, and that's where you get some buy-in. And just like anything else, it's human nature. It's kind of monkey see, monkey do. Hey, you know, such and such mentioned that, you know, he felt a lot better. His low back was less cranky after the flights. When he did XYZ, you mind taking me through XYZ?
Yeah.
Well, and that's when that team, just getting that buy-in.
That's where the rehab team and your staff, that staff side of things, comes in, as far as then the players appreciating not just Neil, you know, not just you for what you offer them, but also for what Andrew offers them, or the strength coaches offer them. Obviously, you know, like you said, it's human nature to not really appreciate things until they slap you in the face. So, I keep saying this will be my last question. Neil, to wrap up, what are, you know, I briefly mentioned when we started this conversation that you obviously have a wide array of tools in your toolbox. You're an LMT, you train in very many different myofascial techniques, dynamic neuromuscular stabilization, DNS. What are some of the things that you guys use in the short term to keep those athletes on the mound or on the field, as you mentioned, when you're in season versus when you have more time for something like PRI? Obviously, PRI does take buy-in, and they do have to appreciate position and mechanics and breathing and all these things that they might not have time for the night before a game. What are some of the other modalities that you find super beneficial in pairing with PRI? Maybe it's in the short term, like you said, maybe it's just to keep them out on the field, but is there a certain, I mean, again, it's all of them, but is there a certain modality or certain modalities that go hand in hand with some of the patterning and positioning that PRI preaches?
I think a piece there to speak on, RJ, would be what we discussed is our approach of in the short term and in the long term. They're acutely in pain. How do we address that piece for them to still be serviceable? What are we doing about it long term? A lot of times on the short term, that's where the soft tissue work will come into play. You know, our whole group is trained in fascial manipulation through the STECOS. Fascial distortion model is another one of our curriculum courses for all of our minor league athletic trainers. You know, have been trained in ART and a number of other techniques. The danger, for lack of better explanation, I'll say it this way. The danger in that is that they can feel better and walk out the door to play that day. But there's times when the soft tissue work that you do, they're not leaving in their body. They're leaving in the body you gave them.
They don't own it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And so that's where, you know, in PRI, we're going to preach about having frontal plane stability and, you know, impingements and instabilities. And so, like, you can get someone out of that, but can they, once they get off a table and get upright, and get reintroduced to this thing called gravity in a reciprocal alternating motion, can they manage that? And so that's where, you know, you want to try to bookend maybe a soft tissue technique through some of those, the modalities or the techniques that we discussed, and get them into something active for them to own. A PRI exercise, a Z Health exercise, LDOA exercise, or a myofascial stretch, or any of the Guy Boyer curriculum, dynamic neuromuscular, you said DNS, like to get them through some, maybe some rolling patterns, to get them into some positions to own how you may have changed, you know, some tissue neurologically, some force, you know, length tension relationships, so that when they leave, they have some ownership of that. So that's something you have to be careful with in doing that dance, in that, you know, you can kind of play with fire, sell your soul to the devil to give them what they want in the immediate, knowing that there could be some longer term ramifications if you don't bring it full circle at some point. You know, FRC, there's so many different modalities that we utilize with these guys, but it ultimately is, you know, how do you try to A, get them out of pain, and then B, get them to own, you know, their positions and postures that they're needing to go out there and minimize injury risk and optimize performance, I guess.
Yeah. Well, and that's a good way to kind of wrap up, Neil, is, you know, we talked about owning your own, you know, getting off the table and owning your position. You talked about, you know, you as a rehab team may be able to recognize their patterns and their positioning that cause those patterns. Obviously with baseball, you mentioned a lot of the injuries that people commonly think of, like, you know, being hit with a ball or diving and hyperextending. It's not necessarily that those are the most popular or wide-ranging injuries. It's more of the overuse patterning, that day in and day out, they're just hammering into themselves. So really, you know, to wrap up, your guys' job and everyone within PRI, you know, as a modality, is to get the client or the athlete to be able to own their own body and to be able to appreciate and recognize, okay, I need alternation, I need reciprocation, not only when I sleep, not only when I'm on the mound, not only when I'm in an airplane, but during all of those things. And so that's kind of, you know, why I think PRI is so cool. And I think that's why you and others think PRI is so cool, is because it really gives people that power to be able to own themselves and own their own body. So I don't know, you know, I think that's a good kind of way to look at things.
Absolutely. Absolutely, RJ.
Neil, we haven't really talked about it much, but of course you should be in season right now, and you're not. I know you're working to get back into regular season play, and it's kind of all up in the air. But, you know, just briefly while we wrap up, is there anything that really excites you as an organization, or, you know, maybe it's you've got some new athletes that you're excited to work with, or you're excited to get back into, you know, the season for this reason? Obviously you're not excited about traveling all the time. We talk to you all the time, and it seems like, I know, for our listeners, I think one of your daughters, Neil, if you don't mind, I'll say you have a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old at home, but I think one of your daughters was born either while you were at the airport or while you were in the air or something. I don't know what maybe you can tell us what actually happened, but I think they put it up on the Dodger screen in the stadium there, like, Neil, you have a new daughter.
That's the not so glamorous part of this job at times, unfortunately. My wife and I, first of all, to be in these jobs and be a married man, you know, you need a good woman behind you, and I'm very lucky in that regard. My wife's an absolute rock star. She's phenomenal. I took this job in November. Our first daughter, here's two quick baseball birthing stories. Our first daughter, Liv, I took the job in November of 15 with the Dodgers. And our first daughter, Liv, was born on opening day my first year. So I missed my first day of work with the Dodgers. I was at Liv's birth. So I wasn't at work. That's the running joke. I wasn't at work for my first day of work because my wife and I had our first daughter, Liv. The second daughter, that was April 4th of 16. Our second daughter, Gia, she was due May 5th. We had a series. There's kind of an unwritten rule in baseball, and good, bad, or in between. Kind of someone's either coming into this world or going out of this world to be missing work in pro sports. And we had a three-game series in San Fran, followed by three games in Phoenix. And then the team was heading to Mexico. We were supposed to go to Mexico to play the Padres for a three-game series. Ironically, our second daughter's due date was Cinco de Mayo, May 5th, and I was supposed to be in Mexico playing baseball. You know, we got through. I checked in with my wife on that road trip. I'm like, hey, my wife was very supportive. She's like, listen, our first daughter, 26-hour labor. This next one's fast, you know, whatever. You know, I flew her sister. Her sister flew into town when I hit the road. But I'm like, San Fran, there's a flight every hour on the hour. It's an hour flight. Phoenix, every hour, you know, flight, no worries. I check in with her through the San Fran series, nothing. Phoenix, the first game, nothing. I get a call at 5:18 in the morning. My water broke. This is May. It's one of those you wish you had a camera in your hotel room where you levitate off your bed, throw stuff in a suitcase, get out, get an Uber. I'm boarding a flight at 6:14 a.m. in Phoenix. So I'm walking onto a plane in less than an hour from the phone call. Hour flight. I should be home in 2.5 hours to be with my wife. As I'm walking down the breezeway, she FaceTimes me and says, meet your daughter. My wife gave birth to our second daughter in our master bathroom on the third floor of our house in 25 minutes. And I was crushed. You know, I'm in the breezeway crying as I missed our daughter's birth. And she literally said it happened so fast. You could have been home and still may have missed it. So yeah, I'm still buying her Mother's Day presents, to say the least, RJ, on a regular basis. And my wife's absolutely fantastic, Laura. And congratulations to you with your new addition, Vivian.
Thank you. Yeah, our labor did not happen in 25 minutes. It was more like a whole day thing. So yeah, there's parts of it that I think I would have been fine going home to sleep for and coming back. But yeah. No, it's all exciting. And I wanted to at least acknowledge, you know, your hectic life and how those things play into, you know, you guys are so good as a unit of taking care of your athletes, but when it comes down to it, you still have to take care of yourself and your family and all those things that are important in your own life to stay healthy. During this time, Neil, I mean, have you stayed, I know you're back at work now, kind of a couple days a week, but just as we kind of end here, have you stayed in touch with most of your athletes through, you know, throughout this time away from the season? Obviously, you know, we're going to get this episode posted in enough time that people realize that we're still dealing with this pandemic and now all these other things. But have you guys been able to still have communication? You still have plans of care, meetings with your team? You know, that's all been able to resume pretty normal. I mean, not normal, but it's all been happening.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of different industries. This is a very unprecedented time for a number of reasons, obviously with the pandemic, and for us to even be able to reopen the Dodger Stadium for workouts, we had to put a pool together of all of our safety precautions and procedures, as well as our spring training facility in Phoenix. So we are able to do small group workouts right now. We check in with all of our athletes, you know, a couple of times a week. I send something out to the front office, you know, once a week, as far as that goes. You know, again, as is any industry right now, I feel like everyone has become Zoom professionals over the last few months. But and then obviously just keeping, you know, track of, you know, everyone's mental health through all of this stuff, and making sure that you're checking in with them, not only as the baseball player for the Dodgers, but just as a human. You know, how are you doing? How's the family doing? You know, we had a player have their first child. I believe it was at the 26-week mark. So very premature. The baby's doing fantastic. Hopefully they'll be able to come home here in a month, but just checking in. Cause it's just an extended family. That you're wanting to make sure that you're keeping track of, whether they're training in Phoenix with our group, in LA with us, if they're at their hometowns training in different places, and just making sure that everyone, you can still remain a team and a community as best you can during times like these.
Yeah, And that's really, I want to thank you again for taking the time to kind of do that with me and us. You know, I mentioned before we started that, you know, you're in our thoughts and minds right now because of being in LA and having all these things thrown at you, and you're not in a normal season. But in regards to just connecting, you know, I had told you it's been too long since we've talked, or since, you know, life goes on and things get busy and we have kids and you have athletes to take care of and we're all busy at home. But what it comes down to is just having that communication and that connection with, whether it be your own athlete, you know, your athletes or your own family. And as you said, really, there's just a fine line between the people you care about at home and the people you care about at work. So again, thanks for being on with us today, Neil. I know we went a little bit long there, and I appreciate you taking the time to sit down. We look forward to having Andrew on. I want to wish you luck on the rest of your whatever happens to be a season. we'll see here as you get back to play. But, you know, we're thinking about you, and I just want to tell you thanks again for being here with us.
Thanks for having me, RJ. I really appreciated it. And be sure to tell the whole crew there in Lincoln that I said hi and said my best as well.
I will. Thank you, Neil.
If you're interested in learning more about the Postural Restoration Institute, you can visit our website at posturalrestoration.com. You can also email me directly at info@posturalrestoration.com or follow us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter to see how PRI Nation is currently applying this science. As always, thank you for listening, and I look forward to having you on our next episode.